Welcome to episode 22 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by our cast of regulars, plus a very entertaining and thoughtful guest, Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Our guest commentator today is Ron Diebert, who's the director of the Canada Center for Global Security Studies and the Citizen Lab at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. Welcome, Ron. Yes, it's a pleasure. Ron is also the author of Black Code, which is a very detailed and up-to-date discussion of some of the threats on the internet, governmental and otherwise. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and the record holder for returning to Steptoe & Johnson to practice law more times than any other lawyer to date. So let's get started with our roundup. This week in NSA, Snowden speaks to NBC, finally gets interviewed by somebody who isn't in the tank for him, and it's an interesting discussion. He refused to answer some questions. Oddly, I thought, he refused to say when he started collecting data. He refused to say how much data he has, other than to say that the government doesn't really know when it says it's 1.7 million documents. Worth speculating on exactly what he's doing there. My guess is both of those things are things that he's using for potential leverage in negotiations with the U.S., that he will plead guilty to a crime that he's willing to plead guilty to or be willing to be tried for a particular crime. And in exchange for the U.S. going easy on him, he'll provide information on exactly what he took and what he did with it. And he's trying to hold some of that back. I don't know, Jason, if that makes sense to you, but that's what I assumed, because here's a guy who believes in openness and wants to talk about all kinds of things, but won't say some basic things about his own personal history and what he took.
Yeah, although maybe that reflects the fact that, as he now claims, he was trained as a spy.
that's right. Well, I cut him some slack on that, because I think he was. I think he's oddly fixated on his credentials as a spy, and maybe this is partly, you know, this is the problem of being an autodidact. He has to prove himself as somebody who never got a college not a high school degree. He really is sensitive to what he achieved in his career. So I cut him slack on that. The thing I don't cut him slack on, and that I thought was most telling, was he was asked, you know, did you really raise these issues before you decided to steal all this stuff and make it public? And he responded to that very clearly. He said, yes, and the NSA has records. They have copies of emails right now to their Office of General Counsel, to their oversight and compliance folks, from me raising concerns about NSA's interpretations of its legal authorities. And in that context, I mean, he was a very plausible spokesman at the time, saying, of course I raise these issues. But in fact, that was a very carefully parsed statement. And we figured that out when NSA, which is getting much better at this rapid response stuff, released within a day the only email they had from Snowden that no one could describe as a whistleblower email. He says, I'm looking at this this document that describes the hierarchy of legal regimes governing intelligence, and it's got the U.S. Constitution at the top, and it's got regulations toward the bottom, and then in the middle it says federal statutes / presidential executive orders. And he writes this you know, I would call it a sea lawyer memo or inquiry saying, well, that implies that executive orders are equally binding as statutes. And I'm not sure that's correct. Maybe I'm wrong. It says, I'm not entirely certain, but this does not seem correct, as it seems to imply executive orders have the same precedence as law. Now, you have to read it that way. It actually doesn't imply that, to my mind. But that is his alleged whistleblowing. It's what he cites when he is asked, did you really blow the whistle? Did you really complain about these things? He presents it in a way that makes you think, oh, he sent all these emails to all these people. But then when you read his email, it's pretty clear he wasn't complaining about the program. He wasn't blowing the whistle. He wasn't going to the general counsel to ask for a review of some of this stuff. He was asking, almost looks like somebody papering the record, trying to catch the agency saying something that isn't quite true. And when he gets caught on this, he insists basically that there must be other emails sent to other places. But since they were all characterized in the same way as raising concerns about NSA's interpretations of its legal authorities, it seems to me it's pretty unlikely that he actually did any of this, any of the whistleblowing that he's been pretending to have done. And what I thought was interesting about it is it's not lying. In fact, it's carefully avoiding a direct lie, but it's profoundly misleading. It's the sort of misleading you wouldn't do unless you thought that your misleading was going to be protected by the inability of the government to declassify the stuff that would show you're misleading the public. And my guess is that if you go back and look at some of his other statements, you'll find that same sort of parsing in ways that are technically not perjured, but which are profoundly misleading. And it raises questions about everything he has said about the agency that you can't back up directly by looking at the documents. At least that's how I came away from it. I thought it was really very revealing. And his instant response, the guy clearly is spending all his time on the internet Googling Edward Snowden. His response was to say, this is obviously a lie. The NSA last time said it didn't have any emails, and now it admits it has one, but now we're going to find more. But again, what the NSA actually said is, after extensive investigation, including interviews, we've not found any evidence to support Mr. Snowden's contention that he brought these matters to anyone's attention. And I think that's actually an accurate description even of his email asking kind of, U.S. government 101 questions. He didn't bring any of these matters to anyone's attention.
I find this whole issue to be a bizarre sideshow. And it's bizarre to me on both sides, really, because I don't think anyone actually believes that this would have made a difference. NSA, went through lots of legal reviews inside the department, outside the Department of Defense and the Justice Department. And everyone determined that this was legal. That's why they did it. They got approval from the FISA court for the parts that needed approval from the FISA court. So if Edward Snowden did raise concerns that all this stuff was illegal, it wouldn't have made one iota's worth of difference because they, people had determined it was legal. So what's the point of all this?
I sort of agree with you, except that he is holding himself out as a whistleblower who found something illegal. I quite agree with you. It wasn't illegal. If he wasn't blowing the whistle, though, then he was just saying, I know it's legal, but I don't like it, and I'm going to put a stop to it.
Well, but I think what he's saying is, I think this is illegal. People who are right-minded agree that it's illegal. No one in the government was ever going to say it was illegal. So in his own mind and by his definition, he was a whistleblower because he was being true to the real Constitution, not the Constitution and statutes as interpreted by executive branch lawyers.
Yeah, I don't think we disagree. It's an act of, as the president said, massive narcissism to think that his view of the law trumps everybody else's.
Right. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's also a wasted exercise because it's not like, even if true, even if what he said was true and there were emails that backed it up, it doesn't excuse what he did after not getting the answers that he wanted. And as you alluded to, I mean, it's a freebie for him because he can say he wrote these emails, then he raised these concerns. And when the government produces the only email that appears to exist, he'll say, you know, they destroyed the other ones or they're not willing to release the other ones. And they're left in a position of having to prove a negative.
I think that's right. But I'm going to assume the government is telling the truth when they said this is the only email they could find because it would be so bad for them if they weren't telling the truth. But it tells us something about Edward Snowden that he would say these things and then stick to them with new peculiar parsings of the record. There's something going on there, and we're going to discover other stuff. I think his claims about the government being engaged in commercial espionage on behalf of U.S. companies is another thing that he's never quite said, but he's so clearly implied it. In context where he was talking to people who wanted to believe it anyway.
Right.
That again, that is, by any realistic assessment, a lie about U.S. intelligence. And so the question is, why is he still misleading people about U.S. intelligence activities? Well, all right. So, he asked him if he was getting support from the Russian government, and he said he was not. But he did not offer any elaborations. And again, with Snowden, now you know, unless he says it kind of expressly and gives you all the qualifications, you can't know what that means. Maybe he's not getting it from the government. Maybe he's being supported by Gazprom, and he doesn't consider that to be the government. So it's hard to know what is going on. He may have a job, although it must be consistent with reading, Googling his name every hour. That was left. It's tough for NBC. They didn't have time to pursue everything, and that was one of the things they let stand. All right. The other news in NSA is the New York Times is trying to make a big issue out of the idea that NSA collects images, and it clearly does. They've got documents that strongly suggest that. I wasn't sure why we were supposed to be upset about that. NSA is not actually the place where you would go to collect images, since they're mostly about communications, and we're still not principally communicating video chats. And much of what was said is, NSA is trying to figure out the who's behind some of the communications, so that when they do have a picture, they are trying to connect it to other pictures that they have that might tell them whether they're dealing with somebody who's already wanted as a terrorist or something of the sort. It's a long article. My guess is it's mostly designed to say, we've been talking about pictures being gathered and face recognition, and you stupid lumpen proletariat in the United States still won't get upset about it, so maybe if we call it an NSA story, you will. That seems to be what's going on there. I couldn't find anything else in that story that got it on page one. The Chinese have said... they've released a report responding to the indictments of five PLA members by saying the U.S. is the principal cyberspace espionage abuser, and citing a bunch of Snowden documents. Nothing particularly new as far as I could see in that.
The unusual characteristic of being true, which is interesting coming out of the Chinese government for a change.
I guess that's right. It's an effort, I guess, to make explicit something that they've been letting other people say for them up to now. Yeah. All right, the FTC, speaking of government releases that may well be true, is there's a long FTC report on data brokers that ends, not surprisingly, with a suggestion that the FTC should have more authority. Michael, did you wade through those 110 reports, pages of report?
I did. Fortunately, not all of it was substantive, and I at least closely read the executive summary, which is only probably about 20 pages. But it's interesting. It doesn't really call for regulation that would limit the conduct or the collection activities of data brokers, but it's really all the recommendations for legislation are geared towards increasing transparency for consumers. So for instance, it would require that the industry basically creates some centralized mechanism like a portal that a consumer could go to and figure out which data brokers have information about him or her, and also give him or her the opportunity to opt out of collection or to correct the data that may be mistaken about him. And it's interesting, too, because there are some recommendations that would affect not just the data brokers, but consumer-facing companies that collect information from consumers and supply them to data brokers. And they would have to, supply to data brokers. So they would also have to provide transparency by telling consumers what information they collect and then share with data brokers. And when it comes to sensitive personal information, they'd actually have to obtain affirmative consent before they could share that. So the implications of the report go far beyond data brokers themselves and affect companies that share with data brokers and that use data brokers.
Is it clear that, you know, everybody knows what a data broker is and everybody knows whether they're supplying information to a data broker? Obviously everybody produces or lots of people produce sensitive information. If you post something on a Facebook page saying, hope you recover from your broken leg soon, you've disclosed sensitive health information, right?
Yeah. Well, they define data brokers very broadly as, quote, companies that collect consumers' personal information and resell or share that information with others, close quote. So I guess you and Jason and I are all data brokers in a sense, so maybe we need to worry about posting policies on our Facebook pages or LinkedIn pages.
Yeah, I bet. That's right. That'll be the first thing we'll say is we'll only respond to your email if you've sent us a waiver. And the other FTC issue, that this is getting weirder and weirder, I have to say, is the LabMD fight, which, as we said, was in litigation in front of the FTC, but now it appears that the company that got LabMD in all this trouble, Tversa, is itself potentially under investigation, according to a draft transcript that came out of a hearing suggesting all kinds of behind-the-scenes activities. Jason, did you make sense of it?
Well, I don't know if I made sense of it or if sense can be made of it, but I can try to describe it. And as you alluded to, the case just gets stranger and stranger. And I actually thought it had reached the high point of strangeness, but now it's breaking through the ceiling with the introduction of famed truth seeker Daryl Issa into the case. I don't know if sarcasm comes across in the podcast, but I hope it does. As Michael discussed on last week's episode, the trial is underway. I think it started on May 20th before an administrative law judge on the FTC's complaint against LabMD, which was filed last year, relating to a 2008 incident in which a LabMD employee had installed LimeWire on her computer to share music and inadvertently exposed an insurance file with information on about 9,000 customers. And then in 2012, the Sacramento Police Department apparently found LabMD documents in the possession of some identity thieves. So, as Michael talked about last week, the FTC says in the case that in addition to the incident that I just described that gave rise to the breach, LabMD's overall data security practices were, in the FTC's words, not close to being reasonable, and that those practices left names and dates of birth and social security numbers and medical test results subject to exposure. But late last week, on Friday, the judge delayed the trial for about 2 weeks because of a revelation that the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, chaired by ISA, is investigating this firm, Tversa, that you mentioned, which is a cybersecurity and an intelligence firm. So Who is Traversa? For those that, even those who followed the case may not know who Traversa is and what they have to do with all this. So LabMD's founder has claimed publicly, including in his book, which we've talked about on previous episodes, that the breach involving the exposure of the insurance file through LimeWire was actually the work of, or a result of the work of Traversa. According to LabMD's founder, Traversa is part of what he calls a, quote, government-funded data mining and surveillance scheme that he says engages in, quote, unquote, psychological warfare to assist in, again, quote, unquote, abusive government shakedowns. And specifically what he says is that Traversa essentially stole the insurance file and then tried to use it to extort LabMD to hire Traversa to engage in remediation of their network and to address the vulnerability that led to the exposure of the file in the first place. And they allege that when LabMD declined to hire Traversa, Traversa turned around and gave the file to the FTC, resulting in this chain of events that leads LabMD to be in this trial today. And he's gone so far, the founder of LabMD, that is, to suggest that Traversa basically works for the FTC and is getting paid by the FTC. Now, Traversa tells that whole story a very different way. Traversa and its CEO actually sued the founder of LabMD and tried unsuccessfully, of course, to stop publication of the book. And in their lawsuit, they say they found the file on LimeWire, that they immediately alerted LabMD to it, let them know it was publicly available, and even provided a copy of the file to LabMD so they could verify its authenticity, and that they then offered to assist LabMD in addressing the vulnerability. And LabMD, as is their right, declined to hire Traversa, and that was the end of it. Now, Traversa says that they provided the file, along with others that they found on peer-to-peer networks, with personal information to the FTC under threat of a subpoena, whatever that actually means. I'm sure we'll hear more about that down the road. So it appears that last week in the trial, LabMD indicated its intent to call the CEO of Traversa as a witness and to call a former employee of Traversa to the stand as well. Now, in court on Friday, the former employee told the judge through his lawyer that he intended to take the fifth required to testify, that he's trying to work out an immunity deal with ICE's committee that would potentially cover his trial testimony. LabMD's lawyer cryptically told the court that the former employee had, and I'm quoting from the transcript, knowledge with regard to central issues in the case, and would be able to testify fully about that knowledge if the immunity were granted. And so that's one of the questions that has to be addressed, is how broad the immunity will be. For the CEO's part, the CEO's lawyer said they had just found out about the investigation that morning and were in no position to advise the court about whether or not the CEO would invoke the fifth, and they needed more time to learn about the scope of the investigation and deciding how to proceed. And that's part of the reason for the continuance. But they said if he testifies, he'll do so by deposition because of some personal reasons. So now the trial is on a recess until June 12th while these immunity questions all get sorted out.
So, you know, when you step back and look at this through a Washington prism, it does make sense if you're the oversight committee, since they got oversight of the FTC and everything else under the sun, to say if Daugherty is right and Traversa was shaking him down and then went to the FTC and drew the FTC into the shakedown, that's of interest in terms of how the FTC makes its cases. And, you know, since the Darrell Issa has no reason to just praise the government for doing a good job, but instead to dig into these things, it makes sense for him to investigate this. And it also makes sense, even if you didn't do anything wrong, to say, I'll talk to you if you give me immunity and otherwise not, because my guess is that getting immunity from the House committee is probably not that hard to do. And so everybody's playing out their assigned roles. It's sort of hard to know whether any of this is going to amount to anything.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't know what kind of world Mike, I don't know what kind of world LabMD is living in where it's looking to Darrell Issa for illumination, which is not really his specialty. I think he specializes in heat more than light. But it's an interesting play by LabMD, and in fact they've trash talked a little bit at the hearing on Friday about whether if the information comes to light that they think will come out of this employee who's taken the fifth, whether the FTC will even want to go forward. So I think the play is to embarrass the hell out of the FTC, and since everything else has failed, and hope that will cause the FTC to back away.
Well, you know, I think if Daugherty's broader allegations about an intelligence industrial complex here are right, we're gonna learn next week that Edward Snowden is next on the witness list. because he'll clearly have inside information about how NSA was involved in getting this information, and boy, that would really make things interesting.
Now, don't say that, because then I'll be next on the list too. I should say, I actually have a lot of respect for Daryl Issa. I think he's a smart guy, and surprisingly good on technology issues. But I understand that's a divisive issue on this podcast for sure.
It's not as smarts that are at issue here. Although I would say, on a somewhat related note, you know, one of the issues at this trial has been whether the FTC would actually be forced to say what standards it uses in evaluating company cybersecurity. And the deputy director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection had provided testimony on that issue the testimony came in last week. And essentially what he said is that there's plenty of information in the public record that companies can use to determine what the FTC standards are, and he pointed to speeches and blog posts and flyers and prior settlement agreements that are out there, basically the same song that the FTC has been singing for the last year or two. And as the lawyer for LabMD not unfairly pointed out, the fact that the FTC has asked for standards and points to blog posts, flyers, and speeches sort of illustrates the fact that there are no standards.
No, that was it's the blog posts and maybe the flyers that make you think, they're scraping the bottom of the barrel here.
Except for our blog.
That's right. they fill the site, our podcast, right, which is full of standards. So let's move on to the right to be forgotten. Google has actually begun already finding a way to implement the right to be forgotten. They've hired a guy, professor from the UK, Luciano Floridi, who is trying to guide them through their compliance. And they've actually put up a little web form, because like everything Google does, these decisions are probably going to be made by a Python script, in which you can fill in your name, the name of the person you're acting for, an email address, and the URLs that you want removed. And they're sort of interesting. Every URL you want to have removed has to be separately identified, which does make sense. And after you have identified the URL, they said that you have to have an explanation of why the URL is irrelevant, outdated, or otherwise inappropriate. Because that really is, I mean, having read that decision a couple of times, the only guidance the court ended up giving to Google. It's supposed to take down things that are irrelevant, outdated, or otherwise inappropriate. The other interesting thing about the Google approach is it appears they're only going to take these things down inside the European Union and in what you might think of as European satellites, Iceland and Switzerland and Norway and one other country, Liechtenstein. Technically, right now, Google's view is it doesn't have to take down the Google.com searches, only the searches that are directly flagged as belonging to European countries. I'm not sure that's right under the decision of the court, but it's arguable, and Google's signaling that they intend to argue it. Let me ask Ron. This issue really pits free expression against privacy. To my mind, all privacy law is an intrusion on free expression, and it deserves a lot more skepticism than it gets. But let me ask you, since I'm guessing that you have a fondness for both human rights, how this is being viewed in the human rights community, and what you make of the right to be forgotten.
Well, it is definitely a complex issue, and I think it's a new one, given the extent to which all of our lives today leave such an enormous digital exhaust behind us. And I think, especially when you think of a person's reputation, how that's impacted by digital media today, it raises some, I think, legitimate questions about how to protect one's reputation, especially when there's false information that then is indexed by very large search engines that can have a negative effect on a person's reputation. I think of this especially as a parent with young children, seeing how much that they both put online and how much is documented about them by their friends, which of course never disappears. So it's a serious issue, but at the same time, I, for one, think that this ruling is not appropriate. I agree with my colleague Jonathan Zittrain, who wrote what I think is an excellent op-ed in the New York Times, Don't Force Google to Forget, that pretty much summarizes my opinion. I think rather than turning to the intermediaries and the search engines and putting pressure on them, we have to think of innovative new ways to address the issue. The one that he proposes, which I think is worth considering, is along the lines of allowing people to have almost like a free ad space next to their name on Google search engine where they could respond. So, you know, addressing speech with more speech rather than censoring. The one thing that Zittrain doesn't bring up that worries me most about this is the precedent it sets for other countries to put pressure on intermediaries to censor for other reasons. Once you start that process in motion and legitimize it, I think inevitably we'll see other countries starting to pressure social media companies and search engines as they are now in places like China, Thailand, other places around the world to...
Put aside those, what about Turkey, where Erdogan expressly said he was trying to regulate YouTube and Twitter in the name of privacy because these people were saying things about Erdogan that weren't true?
Yeah, exactly. So I think you open up a can of worms, really, and it's a heavy hand. Generally speaking, I think, you know, it is a serious issue. I think we need to think of new innovative ways to address it without putting the pressure in the hands of, putting the pressure on the intermediaries to do something which, you know, I think inevitably they will want to err on the side of safety and caution, which ends up limiting speech. And I think that's a precedent that we want to avoid.
Yeah, I think if you listen to people talking about how the YouTube Python script that takes down videos because they are the subject of a DMCA complaint, the seams show, and a lot of stuff gets taken down for reasons that are hard to justify, you can understand why from YouTube's point of view, from Google's point of view, they would not want to make an error that's going to subject them to massive liability. And those errors are all errors of not taking stuff down. So especially if the European Union announces that they're going to, or actually succeeds in adopting a rule that says, if you guess wrong, Google, we will take 5% of your annual turnover, which is, that would be about $1 billion fine for guessing wrong, arguably in response to any one of these takedown requests.
Well, and you know, you brought up a good point, I think, that really is worth underlining about the jurisdictional issues and the practicalities of enforcing it within a certain, either within one country or a region, and what that means for the net overall. I think it encourages greater fragmentation and different a patchwork quilt of laws and rules when it comes to the type of communications experience we have, depending on from where we connect. And ultimately, in the long run, this is counterproductive. I think we need to work towards a communications environment that's seamless and accessible to all, no matter where they connect from. And this moves us further in the opposite direction.
But I like Jonathan Zittrain's approach, because I guarantee that under the Google AdWords auction, there's probably no cheaper set of AdWords than Stuart Baker. And so I could probably Google could give me those to include my rebuttal of the search results that come up when you put my name in, and lose no revenue at all.
Maybe that's how Snowden could employ himself.
Yeah.
Contracting out to provide that service.
There you go. That's right. He's on the net anyway. He's Googling Edward Snowden. He could just Google a few other people. Yes. Great idea. Okay, there's some litigation now in the U.S. that's starting to heat up, if you thought the issue of transparency was resolved by the apparent settlement, between the U.S. government and, the big tech firms, it's puzzling because there seems to be a continued set of litigation over, national security letter, disclosures, that the firms would like to make that they think the government, has not permitted them to make. And they're raising some interesting First Amendment issues. Jason, did you look at those filings?
Yeah, I did look a little bit at them. You know, as you alluded to, the issue seemed to be largely resolved back in January, when the big providers reached an agreement with the government that would allow them to publish the number of NSLs, national security letters, and other requests they get in bands of 1,000 every 6 months with a 6-month delay. But the companies have continued to press forward with litigation trying to challenge the underlying part of the statute that creates national security letters that allows the government to impose a gag order on recipients of national security letters without the approval of a court. In the criminal realm, as you know, if the government seeks to prevent a provider from telling a customer or anyone else about the existence of a government request for information, you've got to get a court to order the provider not to do so. And when it comes to national security letters, that's not the case. So Google and Facebook and Yahoo and Microsoft all filed briefs in April that were recently unsealed, asking the Ninth Circuit to rule, to agree with them that it was a prior restraint on speech for this gag order provision to prevent them from releasing this information publicly. And they argue that this prior restraint prevents them from participating in the public debate over the use of national security letters, a debate that the government has participated in since Snowden. And a number of district courts have ruled on the constitutionality of that provision. At least one in Northern California has said that it's unconstitutional. A couple others have said yes. And those cases are now all consolidated in front of the Ninth Circuit now. The government says fundamentally that there's no First Amendment right to disclose information learned from participating in a secret investigation. The companies respond, not unreasonably, that rule applies to parties to the investigation. It doesn't apply to witnesses. And they draw the analogy to criminal grand jury investigations, where prosecutors, sort of axiomatics, one of the first things you learn as a prosecutor is that you can't tell a witness that they're precluded from sharing what they have testified about or what you ask them. You can ask them not to reveal information to the public or to other witnesses, but you can't require them not to. And the companies say that this is analogous to that situation, in which they are witnesses in an investigation, third parties asked to provide information, and the government can't constitutionally tell them that they can't share information about it. And if they want to be able to do that, they need to get court intervention. Now, the president, as you know, has already said that the government would change the way the gag orders work, so they're no longer indefinite in length, and they would terminate unless the government demonstrates the need for continued secrecy. I guess the question really will be, who does the government have to demonstrate that to? Their own satisfaction or to the satisfaction of the court?
Of course, if this is a prior restraint and we pull out all of the high concept attacks on that, how can it make a difference that the prior restraint comes from a different government official? I mean, the you wear a robe, but you still work for the government. That's where your paycheck comes from. Isn't it still a prior restraint? How do they deal with that?
Well, I guess the court would have to do a constitutional analysis and weigh the restraint on speech versus the public interest served by the restraint and decide with the appropriate level of scrutiny that it meets that test. But, I think they wouldn't be satisfied without a result that allows them to give the information to the public. But I think from a non-legal sort of practical consumer relations point of view, I think frankly the providers, just want to be in a position where, they're not sharing information because a court tells them they can't share it,
right?
Not because they're exercising any discretion not to, or because they're just acceding to the will of the executive branch.
And I can see how, at least if you were a judge, you'd see a big difference between the executive branch and the eminences on the bench.
Sure.
When is that going to come down? When are you going to get a decision?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure when the decision's expected, but I will look into that and report on it next week.
All right. Sounds good. The Iranians are making news with reasonably clever, but ultimately flawed, sufficiently flawed that you should be embarrassed to fall for them, cyber attacks. They have enlisted John Bolton, he of the you know, the most famous neocon mustache on the planet, opening a LinkedIn account in his name and putting their hand on the knee of all kinds of people who might conceivably be interested in conversing with John Bolton, friending them all, and then months after they started their chats, sending out malware to try to break into their accounts. And it's not just John Bolton. Apparently, they've opened up Facebook accounts. These things are usually attractive women with interests that you share. there's a report out by a company called Eyesight Partners. It's one of these really annoying things where, yes, it's available on the web, but when you click the link, it takes you to something where you register and provide a whole bunch of personal information, and then they say, yeah, we'll get back to you. So I haven't seen the report. I'm still waiting to see.
It sounds like an Iranian ploy to get your credentials.
please download this PDF, sir, and we'll be glad to provide you with what you need. Yeah, I've often wondered when, as I'm wandering the net, downloading stuff like this, stories of what the latest PLA tactics are. It has to have occurred to them that the very best place to put malware is on the download files that people are looking for about their very activities. Yeah. So you're always taking a risk when you do that. But the Iranians continue get better at this. Although, as I remember, the email that ultimately was sent out trying to get people to download the file was full of grammatical errors and other things that one wouldn't expect John Bolton to make. So they still need to work on their tradecraft. And then the last topic I just wanted to cover, because I think it's only a little law, but, fascinating. I'm a TrueCrypt user. I don't know if you guys are. TrueCrypt is the most famous, open source crypto, file encryption, hard drive encryption, technology available. Everybody bought into it. And it has just gone belly up, posting a revised version that more or less says when you try to encrypt something, don't use us to encrypt your data. TrueCrypt has pretty much melted down. The question that's been raised is there some kind of NSA, FBI, NSL gag order it was triggered in this by TrueCrypt, and I'm trying to figure out whether there is any way in which TrueCrypt would have closed its doors because NSA or the FBI had tried to compromise TrueCrypt and use the compromise to gain access to a bunch of people's information, using a gag order to try to prevent that from being disclosed. I couldn't find a way, Jason, in which it was at all likely that there was a hidden gag order and there was some kind of secret signal being sent out by TrueCrypt to say, really, the NSA has us and we're being held hostage.
I think if it was a secret signal, it would be a hell of a lot less secret than they've made it. So, I mean, I had the same reaction, which was there has to be some other explanation, perhaps even the explanation they gave. But if it was in response to some gag order from the government, they would find some cryptic but not too cryptic ways of signaling to their users that that was going on.
Yeah, I think this is just a response. Everybody wants it to be NSA, or everybody in this particular community thinks first it must be NSA. The other thing that this reveals is that while TrueCrypt claimed to be open source, there's really, if it's open source, it's the worst open source on the planet, because nobody can actually go back and figure out what it says, what it means. It turns out that the license is not exactly an open source license. So on the whole, it's probably a good idea that TrueCrypt is gone, because it's very messy. It's under audit now, and that may have been one reason that it melted down, a fear that the audit was going to disclose that it was really buggered in some way. Well, let's turn to our discussion with Ron. Ron, you're just coming back from a Swedish conference, if I remember, on surveillance and cybersecurity. What is happening in Europe on these issues after Snowden? And as people take a deep breath and say, what does Snowden mean for European practice in the future?
Well, I think the Stockholm Internet Forum is a good barometer of what's going on, because it's organized by the Swedish government. Carl Bildt, as the Swedish foreign minister, has taken a pretty aggressive position in terms of support for internet openness and freedom. But of course, the Swedish government itself has been caught up in the Snowden revelations, with some of the documents pointing to long-standing cooperation between the Swedish NSA, called the FRA, and the NSA. And not surprisingly, at the conference, there were charges of hypocrisy laid against not only Bildt, but the rest of the Freedom Online Coalition countries who were there. And some of the participants in the conference were upset that Greenwald, Poitras, and Snowden himself weren't either invited or somehow brought into the conference. And personally speaking, I thought that some of that criticism was pretty much self-serving, because there were a lot of people at the conference who were sympathetic to those positions and had ample opportunity to express themselves.
Yeah, obviously Snowden's not going anywhere, right? Does Poitras leave Germany, or does she stay in Germany?
I think she was in New York recently, wasn't she, to pick up an award?
Oh, maybe so. Okay. So it appears that it's only Snowden that really has some travel restraints, so they could have gone.
Yeah, I think there was an interesting discussion about Snowden being in Russia. I found quite interesting. I mean, for some people, this is who are otherwise sympathetic to his point of view, it's a bit disturbing that he's in Russia, obviously. And Andrei Soldatov, who's an investigative journalist in Russia, someone with whom the Citizen Lab has collaborated over the last few years, has been quite critical of the choice and the fact that he's there and what this means. And I agree with that. I think there's some serious questions about what type of restraint he's under, how he's being managed, and exactly what type of representation he has in Russia, all of which are a bit disturbing to me. That said, I think in Europe as a whole, there's a problem. I mean, you have many people who are outraged by the revelations, I guess ignorant of what was going on before, and now concerned about the scope of surveillance. And then you have a lot of, self-serving, cynical attempts to take advantage of the fact that there is mistrust not only in the United States but U.S. companies. A lot of talk about data localization, and nothing is wrong with data localization in and of itself, except of course when it becomes industrial policy and a means to engage in self-censorship or greater national controls. And I think that should be a legitimate concern for citizens.
Don't you think that one of the as governments begin to think with a second wind about what this all means, it is tempting to make this a tool of industrial policy, and it's also very tempting to say, if we localize the data, we'll have access to it, and the Americans won't. So we'll be able to get a whole lot of information without even using a court order, because under German or Swedish law, court, well, I don't know about Swedish law, but under German law, no court order is required. So that it must be very tempting to pretend you're speaking for privacy and actually make life easier for your own intelligence services.
Well, I really worry about that as someone who spends a lot of time doing research in the global south and looking at countries that are non-democratic and what cues they are taking from the responses to the Snowden revelations. And this is where data localization calls worry me most, because it's one thing for a country, a European country, a democratic country to make such an argument. And I frankly think there's some good technical reasons to have more data localization. It could end up speeding up the internet and lowering costs. So there's some economic and other efficiencies to be gained by data localization. But the problem is when it's used as an excuse to exercise greater nationalized controls, then we have to worry. And I think this is precisely what's going on in many countries in the global south. They're taking it as a cue that this is a thing to do. And of course they can subject companies who are investing in their countries to more rigorous state control.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the case, although my sense is that at least in Brazil, data localization is not exactly everybody's cup of tea. It's struggling to, I mean, it was clearly the first instinct of the Brazilian government, but they're having some trouble actually closing that sale, aren't they?
I would say so, and I think if you ask Brazilian activists, human rights activists in that country, they're not all that pleased with the idea of the way the Brazilian government is going with this. Looking country by country, what we're seeing are governments attempting to stand up their own versions of the NSA. You know, this is what everyone else is doing. Same with, cyber commands or building up offensive capabilities. Unfortunately, most of this ends up getting targeted at their own populations, opposition political parties, dissidents abroad, and that's really what I'm concerned about is the unintended consequences of all of this coming home to roost.
Well, I think they're fully intended by the governments that adopt them. In fact, it's easy to say all those tools we've been using on our own people, we'll just start using them on everybody else, or the tools that other people are using against the outside world, we'll use both against the outside world and against our own people. I do think it's fully intended by those governments, not maybe by the U.S. and Western governments, but it's, even if they didn't intend it, the concept is fully out of the bag, and many of the techniques are as well, thanks in part to people like Jake Applebaum, who just disclosed an entire catalog of tools that authoritarian governments might want to use, claiming to be speaking for democracy, but actually causing massive harm, I think.
Or you think of what Applebaum did, I think there's a catalog of such products that's marketed to those countries anyway in secretive trade shows that are restricted to defense and law enforcement agencies. I mean, they don't need to pick up Der Spiegel to find out about them. They just need to go to ISS and find out about them directly from the vendors.
Yeah, although I think probably it would be difficult to sell some of those things to some of the most loathsome governments, but they can certainly sell them to people who are, yeah, I think so.
Our research has shown the opposite. Hacking Team, Gamma Group products sold to some of the world's most notorious abusers of human rights.
That's interesting. I work in this area, and at least in the U.S., export controls, although they're not perfectly suited to these tools, have been sort of repurposed so that it's not so easy to sell this without an export license. And the export licenses are particularly focused on sales to governments. So it would be difficult certainly to sell it to Syria or to Iran or until very recently, Burma, North Korea. Those are countries, and I'm guessing China as well, are off the table.
So, it's a moving target. I think if you look back the last few Citizen Lab reports, we found instances of Blue Coat products in all of the countries that you just mentioned. And Blue Coat is an American company. And of course, this led to calls for fines and actual fine levied against a reseller of Blue Coat products. I agree that the United States, the way in which the United States is addressing this issue is much more sophisticated than any other country out there. The problem is that these companies are not just U.S. companies. So, Gamma Group is a UK company, a German company. There's Hacking Team based in Milan, Italy. These are very sophisticated intrusion software products that are now showing up, in the hands of some of the world's most notorious abusers of human rights and countries, frankly, that can end up being our adversaries. How to address that market, I think, is a very important, topic. I'm glad the United States is taking the steps that it is, and the Vostanar arrangement has been modified. The devil is in the details now.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. And I don't do any work for Blue Coat, but I want to say for them to bandy their name about and then say that sanctions were imposed on a reseller, and not on Blue Coat after an investigation, says that, the reseller took the software and engaged in unauthorized sales. So it's not exactly Blue Coat's fault that that happened. Otherwise, they would be under the hammer as well. But what it does disclose, and I think, is that two issues that traditionally export controls have struggled with are very prominent in this area, which is one, alternative sources in other countries, so that something is commercially available, and therefore you can cut off your own nose to spite your face or to show what a wonderful moral person you are, but you won't actually keep the people that you're denying licenses to from getting access to it. You'll just keep them from getting access to your country's stuff. And second, it's just software. Anybody can copy it and sell it. The idea that you're going to get effective controls on a piece of software. Well, ironically, it was a bunch of human rights people who made that point when we were talking about encryption software, that encryption software couldn't really be effectively controlled, and they thought that was a wonderful thing. They're a little less sure that this is a wonderful thing, but I don't think that technically there's much difference.
Well, it's definitely a topic that requires a bit of nuance. I think I would add there are a couple of other areas that we need to be concerned about when we're considering things like export controls and sanctions. You know, one would definitely be encryption. And I think if you look at some of the follow-on conversation with Vostanar, many people are stressing that when it comes to countries actually building out the law around this and how to deal with this practically, we need to make sure not to confuse encryption with the markets that we're trying to target here. The other very important area is research. We don't want to limit legitimate research and confuse research into exploits and vulnerabilities with the vendors who are selling these technologies. I think the point about software is an important one. Many people have made that argument for a long time that, you know, this is information, it's impossible to control. There's a certain amount of truth to that, but I think it can also be exaggerated. After all, when we're talking about the sector, we're talking about companies that have shareholders, that have CEOs, that have headquarters, that have revenue streams and bank accounts, and all of those are factors that are material that can be targeted when it comes to exercising intelligence sanctions.
Yeah, I think that's right, but all of those things make it make controls not a matter of we're going to be able to turn off the spigot, but maybe we can direct the flow in a different direction. So instead of a spigot, what you've got is a garden hose, and you can push it in certain directions, and you can hope that that the water doesn't land on other parts of the garden. But the likelihood that you're really going to keep that garden completely dry is pretty remote.
I think the importance of the type of research that we do is worth highlighting, because you're never going to completely turn off this type of market. Raising awareness about it, showing where the market exists and who are the the suppliers, who are the purchasers, how it's being used, ends up being quite important, because then there are different avenues that can be used to redress the market. For example, in our last report on Hacking Team, the company I mentioned that sells intrusion software, we found that the Ethiopian government had purchased this product and was targeting journalists based in the United States, in Virginia. I mean, apart from the just the bizarre nature of that, Ethiopia, one of the least connected countries in the world, is using advanced intrusion software not to target its own citizens, but Americans living in Virginia. This was the story that was on the front.
Well, for those who have taken cab rides in Virginia, it's no surprise there's a large Ethiopian community here.
Yeah, well, these were, you know, Ethiopians operating a satellite broadcasting service in Ethiopia. These weren't cab drivers. These are journalists who are U.S. citizens. And for that reason now, the EFF is representing some of them, suing the Ethiopian court in the United States. I think that's an interesting follow-on. In fact, looking over the last couple of weeks, I've counted as many as 6 public litigation efforts undertaken as a result of research around this type of intrusion software that we've done. It's not the type of thing that Citizen Lab does. This is follow-on to our research, and it's a different way of responding to the market than export controls or sanctions.
That is interesting. I don't know how you get around foreign sovereign immunity, because there's nothing more sovereign than breaking into people's computers and stealing their secrets. That's what intelligence agencies do. So it's going to be a tough row to hoe. Has anybody brought cases against China? I know you've got a report coming out about some of the Chinese exploits, and I wondered, since they're such an obvious and unrepentant user of this technique, whether they've been sued too.
Well, I've been following the incident with interest, and for us at the Citizen Lab, this is an especially important precedent, because we have been arguing for some time that the same campaigns, the same people, if you will, agencies who are targeting Fortune 500 companies and government agencies coming out of China, have been persistently targeting civil society groups and human rights organizations. The big difference, of course, is that those organizations cannot defend themselves. They have very little capacity to even defend their own networks, let alone hire the Mandiants or Trend Micros of the world to look into it and fix it. And unfortunately, I think they're also left out of the equation when it comes to policymaker speeches about the threats of China cyber espionage. Let's not forget that civil society represents an enormous swath of the population that we should be concerned about. It's not just...
Absolutely. No, it is surprising to me that there's not more outrage that... some of these governments are trying to interfere with the workings of democracy and free speech inside the United States by spying on and, in some cases, retaliating against people for things they do here.
Exactly. So once our report comes out, we'll show, based on many years of data that has been shared with Citizen Lab researchers by human rights organizations who formally enrolled in a study that we have run here, that the very same organizations, the very same malware in some cases, the same campaigns is targeting these groups, and yet they're defenseless. And I think that's an important thing that needs to be addressed.
So do you have Ugly Gorilla's signature on some of this stuff?
We have extraordinarily detailed empirical evidence showing overlap exactly with some of the major campaigns, including APT1, that major security vendors have identified in their reports. And if you look at those reports carefully, Mandiant, Trend Micro, and so on, they usually list in just a kind of throwaway category civil society or NGOs, because it's not profitable for them to address that sector of society. It's much more profitable because they're, you know, the Fortune 500 companies and so on can afford their services. I think it's a serious gap. It's it's a market failure, if you will, that needs to be addressed. I would say the same goes for the foundations. The big foundations in the United States that support all of the human rights and civil society work are likely themselves targeted, and they don't even know it. I think they could do a great service by being more transparent about the fact that they're targeted and put some spotlight back on China. I'm not, you know, excusing what has come to light in terms of the NSA revelations. That's a whole separate conversation. But I think, again, one of the unfortunate consequences is it's minimized in the public spotlight the extent to which China is doing this relentless campaign against many of these civil society organizations.
Yeah, I think that's right. And listen, Citizen Lab has done enormous public good with its early stories. The story about the Dalai Lama's network and compromises in 2009 really opened a lot of eyes to the extent of hacking and the aggressiveness of it. And you continue to lead in exposing those details. So I'm very much looking forward to your report. Can I ask you one question before we turn to the closing remarks? I don't understand the one Canadian quote-unquote scandal that came out of the Snowden papers. The scandal was that CSIC, which is the Canadian version of NSA, had picked up the Wi-Fi signatures of mobile phones going through its airports, and then tracked those mobile phones as they logged on around the city, around the country, maybe around the world. And since a phone checks in every time it finds a friendly or you know a familiar Wi-Fi antenna, you can learn a lot about where these people go after they leave Toronto Airport. And the allegation was, well, they must be tracking these people, including Canadians. Now there's been a report that says, no, they weren't tracking Canadians or anybody else. They were just collecting metadata. I'm not sure I understand exactly how that distinction was drawn or what that means. And I figure while I've got you on the phone, I'll ask you, what is this scandal about exactly? And what does the, oversight report actually mean?
So I was one of the people that the CBC, asked to, examine and give advice on the documents that they were entrusted with on this story. So I had a full peek at the unredacted documents. And I was actually unhappy with the way the story was reported, because it was reported in the way that you're describing it, that the government was collecting information from free airport Wi-Fi and using it to model Canadian communications. In fact, it was different than that. At least from my reading of the slides, our NSA, CSEC, was going to several databases and archives of Canadian communications data, including from one called Special Source, which I assume to be a major telecommunications company in this country, and then taking all of that data and modeling as best they can the behavior of communication patterns as people transit through airport Wi-Fis, lounges, but also enterprises, it says on the slides, hotel coffee shops, hotels, and so on at major Canadian cities and airports across the country. The problem is that in terms of the mandate of CSEC, this doesn't seem to fall within any of the mandates. And when it comes to oversight of our own CSEC, we have far less of it than that which exists in the United States. There is a retired CSEC commissioner, a retired judge who acts as the oversight commissioner, who issues an annual report. CSEC is not accountable to Parliament. There are no committees that can compel the CSEC chief to testify. So we have a kind of a problem in terms of the oversight in our country, and we're just not sure exactly what's going on in terms of what they're doing, whether they're following the law or not. And then when it came to reporting on the story and some of the answers that were given by the government, it appeared to be as if they're speaking a different language than the rest of the human race, because on the surface of it, you look at this, it seems to be that they're gathering communications, whether it's metadata or not, and analyzing it as Canadians go about their daily lives.
So is it possible that what they were doing was essentially anonymized? They said, let's take a sample of people who log on to the Toronto airport free Wi-Fi, take those identifiers, and then watch to see where the identifiers show up next, and in an anonymized way say, here's a pattern of traffic for people who go through the airport?
It's possible. But we have no assurance to say whether that's the case or not. And furthermore, it's not the type of, is it okay for the government to experiment on that type of data in this way without a warrant?
Oh, I'm sure that that's true because, at least in the U.S., the answer would be, come on, you give this information away free so that you can get access to the Wi-Fi. You've already given that to a third party, and the third party can share it if the third party chooses in the absence of some special legal restriction. In the U.S., there would be a legal restriction, but it could be overcome with a subpoena. And in most countries, and probably including Canada, you can do that even without a subpoena. And especially if it's anonymized in some fashion so that they're not telling you anything. They're not even giving you the identifying information. They're just saying this particular phone checked into the following 22 places within a week of passing through the airport. You don't know who it is. You just know that's a typical pattern or not.
Well, the problem is, Stuart, when you look at the other side of the equation and what the telecommunications companies are giving to the government, there was a report that came out just a couple of weeks ago that where it was revealed that telecommunications agencies routinely give to the government on the order of millions of times a year user data without a warrant. And so the norm here is quite a bit different. We have nothing like transparency reports when it comes to telecommunications companies in Canada. It's a big black hole. There seems to be a practice or normal routine where government agencies, including CSEC or border services agencies, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, simply go to the telecommunications companies, ask for that type of data, whether it's anonymized or not, whether it's done lawfully or not, under what law, we just don't know, because there isn't a high level of confidence I have or many people have in this country as to the oversight that exists. We have one retired judge who once a year issues an annual report. The CSEC chief reports to the Minister of Defense, so it is oversight within the security tent and therefore, in my opinion, structurally flawed.
Well, the lesson that no one is willing to draw, even though it's obvious from the Snowden disclosures, the U.S. leads the world in oversight of its intelligence agencies and in protections against abuses, even better than Canada. You heard it here first. This is the part of the program where we allow people to talk about the stuff that's upcoming that they'd like to draw our listeners' attention to. I know you've got the book out, and that's been out for about 6 months, if I remember right. Would you like to talk about that or other things that you think listeners should be paying attention to in the future?
Well, at the Citizen Lab, we have a continuous stream of research projects on the go. I would like to point to an area of our research that is very exciting, and that is the extent to which popular instant messaging applications and chat applications that are used on the order of hundreds of millions of people throughout Asia, and especially in China, where they're very popular, have embedded within in them keyword filtering and surveillance functionality that we are systematically analyzing through reverse engineering the clients and finding out exactly what keywords are pushed to the clients secretly without users' knowledge. This is one of the most exciting areas of our research right now. I think it's one with huge policy and legal implications because, of course, many of these applications do not abide by their own terms of service, are used as a vehicle to enforce public policy by authoritarian governments, and I think are ones that many users have no idea what is happening beneath the surface. So it's very important research. And
obviously that's those keywords are going to change over time. I hope you guys are going to start a website that will allow us to see, you know, what governments and perhaps the private sector doesn't want us to say or wants to know when we say, because that will be a valuable tool in trying to figure out what really gets under their skin the most.
Absolutely. You can find out about it on our website. We have detailed lists of all the keywords at citizenlab.org.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for that. Jason, any upcoming speeches that you've got?
Just one. On June 12th, I'll be in Philadelphia for the Net Diligence Cyber Conference. I'll be moderating a panel with the assistant AGs of several different states on how state attorneys general make decisions about which breaches they investigate and which ones they don't.
Oh, cool. That's immensely valuable information for people who've just suffered a breach. And I will be tomorrow at the Ronald Reagan Building for Bloomberg Government's Cybersecurity Getting to Business conference on a panel talking about cybersecurity issues. On Wednesday, God help me, I'm doing the Brookings International Implications of Snowden panel that Ian Wallace put together for Brookings. Next Monday, CSIS is rolling out a report that I did with Jim Lewis about the costs of cyber insecurity. We're holding back the number, so I can't tell you, but it's a big number. Into the belly of the beast, I will be addressing the Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference on June 10 in Northern Virginia, which should be entertaining. Please come, but don't bring rotten fruit.
We'll get you some security.
I may need it. I may need it. So this has been episode 22 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas, Jason Weinstein, and Ron Diebert. We hope you'll join us next week when we'll be joined by Mike Pompeo, a congressman from Kansas who is a member and a very well-regarded member of the House Intelligence Committee, and once again, we'll be providing insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.